development before we ever put out a product, because we use only FDA supervised facilities to manufacture for us, because what we say is in them is in them, because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horseville.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Is about 4 minutes into hour three, and when some of the great heroes that horse players and fans get attached to, whether they bet on them or just a horse that they use as a touchstone to their involvement in the game, when they pass it always feels good to connect with the people that made those careers possible. And Daryl Viena is joining us when word came late last week that Gilded Time at 31, and that's a nice healthy age to for a retired racehorse and stallion to make it to. I knew I wasn't going to miss a chance to have Daryl join us. Daryl, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
Too long. And I always reference Shug. Shug has got the great stoic attitude about this. The milestones when horses pass, and your terrific training career. And we think about everybody that was involved, David Milch, and what went into Gilded Time's perfect juvenile season. And sorry that we lose him, but 31 gave a lot of people a lot of thrills.
Yeah, he was a very good horse, and we always still retain the memories of these exhilarating and special times.
Talk about the origins. Talk about the origins, Daryl, with him, because I don't recall them at all.
Right. Well, I first saw Gilded Times at the two-year-old in training sale at Calder. I was there with Dennis Lynch, who's no longer with us, rest his soul. I watched Gilded Time in the preview and thought he was outstanding, the outstanding individual at the preview. To me, he stood out like a fire in the night. We ended up buying him for David Milch. Gilded Time was a very sturdy chestnut colt. He had a big white blaze and, if I recall, three white on three of his legs. he was always an independent and self-possessed horse, but he was not aloof. Like all good horses that I've been around, he was highly intelligent and inquisitive. And when you're around him, you always had the feeling that he would allow you to handle him or to bridle him or to saddle him, but simply because he allowed it. And if he didn't want that to happen at any time, he would let you know that wasn't going to happen. I felt like in his crop, he was a man among boys. He was the kind of horse that I don't remember him ever spooking at anything. When most horses are confronted with something new or unexpected, they'll kind of startle and turn away. He would always seem to face those, if he not really orienting to something new, but challenging something new. He was, of course, enormously talented, but in the morning, galloping, he never really looked that good. He never looked really good until he was at racing speed. When he could stretch his body out and reach an open stride, that's where he became what he was. And at those times when he was moving at speed, he was like magnificence in motion, a flash of nature's art. And I feel very lucky and blessed to have been to have made his acquaintance, if you will, and to spend those exhilarating times with him.
You know, you go back to the debut. He debuted at Hollywood in July, and it had a bad start, actually. And Stevens rode him just that one time, and then McCarron would ride him the rest of his career. But he obviously, I mean, win at First Asking, and ends up winning off by widening lengths. And you took him to Jersey. I mean, talk about the campaign as it built up to the juvenile.
Right. Well, I want to start with that maiden race. David Milch was known to, let's say, invest heavily in the outcome of races. And he'd asked me before Gilded Times first started about what his chances were when he was entered. And I had told him something that I'd never told anyone, much less David, knowing what impact the information would have on him. I told him that he could wager as much as he wanted because Gilded Times couldn't be beat. And I was sitting with David at Hollywood Park at the start of that first race. And when the gate opened, I think Gilded Time was more curious with the starting gate crew than he was with the gate itself. And so after the field had left the gate, he sauntered out and was many, many lengths behind. And David was absolutely mortified. He was shaking his head, and he said to me, "Couldn't be beat, huh? Couldn't be beat." And I said to him, "It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, David." And he says, well, I think David thought at that moment, when he was so anguished, that when I said it didn't matter, that I was saying it didn't matter that he'd lost whatever enormous sum he'd placed on Gilded Time. What I meant was that regardless of how far behind the pack he broke, he's still going to win. So when in fact he did, easily close the distance, circle the field around the turn, and finished well going away in front. Of course, David was very happy. And then going on to the rest of his career, two-year-old career, we went to New Jersey, won the sapling. He broke the track record. Then we went to Arlington Park for the Arlington Washington Futurity, and that was the first time at a mile. And the track was really sloppy, and he just kind of splashed through it and won pretty easily. And then, of course, the Breeders' Cup. It doesn't mean me to explain it. I think everybody's seen the Breeders' Cup.
We're going to listen, actually, to it in a minute. But, he beat some good horses along the way, and certainly when it came to the juvenile, faced off against, you know, a good group. But it what's notable to me, Daryl, as part of this, is the way you moved him around that, you know, that summer and into the fall. I mean, to take a 2-year-old and ship him across the country, you know, the Sapling was a grade 2 at the time, as was, you know, the Arlington Washington. But he certainly got plenty of experience, but he made essentially, what, 3 cross-country trips as a 2-year-old. That seems like, you know, like a lot. It kind of speaks to what you said earlier about, you know, being a sensible horse and one that you had confidence in. Obviously, you don't put him on a plane like that so readily.
Right. That's correct. You know, he's just very durable, and he had that personality and just that natural-born toughness.
Gets the experience on a wet track, as you mentioned, at Arlington in September, and then you get ready for the juvenile. What prompted, I'm curious, what was there anything involved with the move to McCarran after Gary had won the debut?
You know, I don't remember. I would suspect it was that Gary may not have been available. We wouldn't have, you know, there was certainly no reason to on our own to change riders. Just a long time ago, and I don't remember.
No, you're certainly in good hands. In good hands with Chris McCarran. Getting ready for the you know the Breeders' Cup, Daryl. He had been favored in every start, and obviously we'll talk about, you know, the time off in a minute, but you know, what were the thoughts heading to Gulfstream to get ready for the juvenile?
I don't know. I was always so confident in the horse that I just, what I told David the first time he ran, I felt all the way through that he couldn't be beat. So,
wow.
I just never felt so strongly about the ability of a single horse.
Amazing. Amazing. We're going to listen to the 1992 Breeders' Cup Juvenile, 2-1 for Gilded Time, and you'll hear the names as Tom Durkin walks through the field, and certainly a performance wise, you'll sense. I recommend to people, if they don't remember watching this race or the last time they saw it, what an effort this is. Gilded Time, Chris McCarran, Daryl Vienna, and David Milch, and the Silverman's timeless moment. 2-year-old is going to finish his juvenile season undefeated. Here it is.
They're off. And Fight for Love breaks alertly, flashing his early speed. And Gilded Time is also right there on the far outside. River Special, Secret Odds, also there in Caponostro. And they race into the first turn, Caponostro and Secret Odds. And those two hook up early. Firm Pledge, the Europeans there toward the inside. River Special is up close to the pace, running fourth. Undefeated Gilded Time is fifth toward the inside, behind a lively early pace. Then it's a break of 3 lengths. And on the inside, Sea Hero is now running in sixth position. In between horses, strolling along, is now seventh, followed by his fellow color bearer, Living Vicariously. He's running eighth now. Fight for Love is tailed off. He's back in a ninth. Mountain Cat on the outside is tenth. Then farther back, Devil's Rock. It's a little known fact. And a slow starting Sudden Hush trails the field. 22 3/5 seconds for the opening quarter. A dazzling half here in 46 flat. It's Secret Odds now, who's starting to shake loose from Caponostro. River Special right there. Gilded Time has been taken to the outside for a clear run. He's poised in fourth position and ready to move as they move into the far turn. And then Sea Hero is right there and strolling along, is being pushed along on the outside, followed by Firm Pledge, then Living Vicariously. It's a little-known fact, is now beginning to pick it up, moving toward the top of the stretch. It is a River Special in front by a head. Gilded Time is right at his neck on the outside. Caponostro is bravely running in third. Secret Odds toward the inside, then Sea Hero. It's a little-known fact, was fanned 7 wide into the stretch. And it is Gilded Time and River Special. And River Special stubbornly at the inside. Gilded Time on the outside is resolute. It's a little-known fact, is closing fast. But it is Gilded Time. Gilded Time, it's a little-known fact. Gilded Time, undefeated and a champion. And on the outside, it's Rivers up for second, and Rivers special was third.
Darrell, I know that you...
Back
in March, I happened to see you at the races, and you said, for the first time in my life, I went to a sale and I bought the best horse. How does it feel to be vindicated?
Well, it feels good, Dan. It certainly isn't a surprise. This horse has made a lot of promises to it, and he's kept every one of them.
I love it. Darrell, when was the last time you heard that?
I can't even remember the first time we did it.
I love it. You know, it's funny because it's a little known fact, ends up, you know, at a big price, 40 to 1 plus, or almost 50 to 1, ends up second for Exacta Players. But the race was with Bob Hess Sr.'s River Special and Gilded Time. They put on a nice show down the stretch.
Right. Although I think it was Bob Hess Jr.
Was it Junior by that point? Oh, it was. Actually, you're right. And I'm just looking down at the chart. It was Bob Junior. With DeSormo and Shook.
That pair is still going strong today.
Right? Here it is. Here it is 30 plus years later. That's right. It's pretty funny. 29 years later. Championship, you know, sealed and, you know, undefeated as a juvenile. And then some travail. You know, talk about what happened, you know, subsequently that kept him from being able to race as a three-year-old until the end of the year.
Right. So after the Breeders' Cup, that year the track at Gulfstream, where the juvenile, where the Breeders' Cup was held, I thought was extraordinarily hard.
Mm.
In fact, I can remember in the work up to the Breeders' Cup, the Europeans were, they hadn't been over this often, that often for the races, and I thought they were working their horses pretty hard on those tracks and didn't realize how hard the tracks were. So we actually went very easy with Gilded Time because I thought the track was extraordinarily hard. And so anyway, coming out of that race, he was, we gave him some time off. We'd always intended to give him some time off. But his speed had really changed after that race. He was a little uncomfortable at times. Couldn't get no radiographic changes, but he was warm in his feet off and on and just not the same horse. So we gave him a lot of time and tried a lot of things. I never thought he got back to what he was, but he was at least sound. But he wasn't moving the same way. He was moving evenly and balanced, but not the same way. And as we went later in the year, he got progressively closer to what he'd been. We were thinking about, gosh, we can't get a race in him, and we really wanted to go back in the Breeders' Cup. And as we approached the Breeders' Cup, he was getting fit, and so we entered him, but there was some hesitation on the part of the Breeders' Cup to let him into the race since he hadn't even participated that year. So he hadn't done anything since he won the juvenile, and we're now into latter part of the following year. But anyway, they let him in as a wild card horse, and he ran very, very well. It was disappointing to me because I always felt he would always win. And after the race, he was coughing a bit. We scoped him, and we started to see that there was some, say, fluff or softness in his soft palate and his cartilages. So he was starting to get some restriction in his wind. And I think that probably led to, I don't want to take anything away from the horse that beat him, but I don't think that, you know, after we learned all of those things and the fact that he'd been away, you know, had, let's say, a little ring rust, but for those things, I think he would have won again. And we treated that, and it seemed to improve. We raced him one more time, but he wasn't himself, and then we decided he's done plenty. There's no sense going any farther.
Well, and that would have been essentially would have gone down. He gets beat by less than a length by Card Mania, and Maya Farah was in between for Gary Jones and Gary Stevens. But if he had won that race, Darrell, it would have gone down with De Haas. I mean, as just even just hitting the board after essentially a year off, to me, and from a FIG standpoint, it was his best performance too, which is notable. Amazing, to come.
It was a really interesting time for me. I was going to law school at the same time. And so it was just a very intense time for me all the way around.
Well, for those that forget the 1993 Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita, and I was there, as it happens. It was my first trip to Santa Anita. And in addition, obviously, to the top three, Card Mania, Maya Farah, Gilded Times, 30 Slews was fourth. Demolute Demashoot, who was tough, was fifth. You had Fly So Free in this field, Bird on the Wire, Ali Deed. I mean, this was an old fashioned Breeders' Cup sprint field of 14. We don't get as many of these in the sprint anymore now that they've kind of segregated out, the fillies and mares and turf and everything else. But this was a serious group. He went on, to a very serviceable career as a stud. I see his name in nice pedigrees.
Right, I think he started to show up more in these on the broodmare side.
Yeah,
I don't think he was necessarily fashionably bred or from a line of stallions that were notable. I mean, just mediocre, I think. And it's funny, you can't always equilibrate talent with having the talent to pass it on.
Well, and just the fact that
I don't think he ever got anything as good as he was.
Just the fact that he was, a Mangorian bred, right? I mean, that Harry Mangorian had bred him. There had to be there was quality, buried in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask tomorrow with Sid. We'll let Sid riff a little bit and talk about what he's we'll dig up a few places there that Gilded Time has contributed to to sons and daughters down the line. Talk about David a little bit too, and the relationship with him. One of the game's biggest supporters.
And David was one of a kind. He could be the nicest and wisest person that you've ever met, and then there was another side of him. Thank good I was always on the best side of him. He is incredibly brilliant. He could, talk about anything at depth for any amount of time. You could never spend a minute around David without learning something. He was a horse lover to the nth degree. He loved horse racing. He'd been around horse racing with his father, who was a doctor at Saratoga. And, when he came to Hollywood, I think from Yale as a assistant professor or some teacher, and he, I know he'd submitted one script for I think it was Hill Street Blues. And I think he went on to win an Oscar for the very first script he put. I may have that wrong, but that's the best of my recollection. And David understood people in a way that was extremely rare. He could meet and talk to someone, be the most gracious person in the world. And, you know, he could tell you all about them after speaking with them for 5 minutes. He understand the dynamics of human relationships and what people say and what they don't say and what it really means. And he was very astute in that same degree with horses and especially handicapping. He could assimilate all the variables that have to go into handicapping, and then he would act upon it. And of course, he had the personality that the outcome had to be meaningful. So I think it got him into betting more and more money.
Wow. This is undoubtedly one of the great thrills, and for you, I mean, Daryl, you're obviously close to the game with the legal practice these days after retiring from active training, but you know, you look at your career, for people that don't realize, I mean, just how many, you know, the stake winners and stake wins that you had as a trainer, and really a premium level training career. I'm sure it's hard not to, you know, think of Gilded Time as you kind of referenced, as, you know, the best of all of that, but it hardly was a standalone success.
Yeah, breaking was very good to me, that's for sure.
It
still continues to be good to
me. That's right. I had to check because I couldn't remember who made me the last time when we talked about a stake winner, but it was Sea Sage who won the last Tycoon in 15. But Star Parade, we certainly had conversations about the wonderful Star Parade.
Yeah, she wasn't bad for an $8,000 purchase.
No, not at all. And Janet, another one of your nice grade one winners, and plenty to, and lots of different kinds too. You know who it's a horse I don't ever remember bringing up with you was Swances, and seeing what Red, you know, the success of and the expansion of Red Baron's Barn. Were you instrumental in some of their early activity?
Yes, for the Jed Cohen and his sons are. And his wife Bobby are all part of Red Baron's Barn. Jed and I are still very, very close. He's been like a second father to me. When I was actually just frustrated and growing tired with training and being becoming more interested in the law, Jed said to me, "You know, you don't have to do this. You do what you want to do." And he's always been a person who's, I always go to for advice, because he's a wise, wise man. And frankly, I think that Kim, Jed's oldest son, has taken over, I think, the acquisition of livestock. I think he's done a splendid job. I think he's surpassed in a few years what we did in many years. And I'm very happy to see it, because there's no one who's more deserving of success in racing than Mr. Cohen. He was the greatest person to train for. At the slightest indication that any horse had anything wrong with them or could benefit by any rest, that was it. You just stopped. You know, it was a luxury that you never having to wrestle with an owner about what's the best for the horse. If you told him that the horse needed rest, that was it. So just an exceptional individual, and I'm glad that they're continuing on and doing very well.
They've become so prominent and a fixture, and it's a historic property, Rancho Temescal, and haven't you know, I've talked with some of the different trainers that have had success, but I'm always intrigued. I find their, you know, what they've done to be really admirable, and I always particularly when I'm just handicapping, I look closely and take them seriously. That sort of leads to a follow up question. Daryl Vienna is with us. We talked about Gilded Times career. The state of things from your perspective, if you don't mind, Daryl. Yeah, for the industry and obviously, you know, there's ongoing concern about California and being kind of out on an island as a, you know, racing jurisdiction. Some thoughts, from an observation standpoint for you, and also you could, if you want to fold in some of your legal work, feel free.
Well, I think I'll stay away from that legal work.
Okay.
But the what I see is happening. There's been, I think, vast societal changes, and as they reflect on horse racing, there's a disinclination among a lot of the public, and it's fueled by, I think, activists, animal activists, that racing isn't really very good for horses. And in California, let's say we have politicians that are responsive to that, and they put a tremendous amount of pressure on the industry to basically make an activity which is ultra hazardous safe, and that's just not going to happen. When horses are running as fast as they do on legs really no bigger than ours in terms of diameter, at high speeds, even on the safest of tracks, there can be that bad step. But that bad step could happen anywhere. But, you know, it could happen out in the range with a wild Mustang. I think the burden is upon racing to do the best they can under the circumstances, but I am really concerned with the future because society changes and things that were once acceptable may go out of fashion or become basically unacceptable. So I am concerned, and I don't know what the answer is. I always say to people that opine that, you know, these horses don't really want to run. And, you know, we're forcing them to do things. Well, first of all, I've never felt that we've ever forced any of the animals to run. They're kind of bred to do it. But more importantly, humans engage in activities that are for their benefit, their sustenance, or their entertainment, and involves animals. You know, I don't think a steer likes the idea of being a hamburger or a pig to be a spare rib. And at some point, we have to draw the line between what are the rights of animals and what is the dominion and control of men. And my feeling is humans are going to use animals for their benefit, but in doing so, our obligation is to treat them as humanely as possible and to keep them to be good stewards of these animals.
Mm.
Yeah. But I wish I could paint a more optimistic picture, but from here in California, I see tremendous pressures against horse racing.
Do you sense that industry leadership out there? I mean, you've got so many. We just talked about the Coens. I could bring up Samantha Siegel, and there's countless Gary Barber. I mean, there's countless top owners that are California based. Does leadership and of course you got to fold in essentially the track ownership is confined to, you know, to Del Mar and to the MTC and Stronach Group. Is the influence and the will there to sustain California?
Yeah, I really can't comment on because I don't have the knowledge of what the intentions of the Stronach Group are long term for racing in California. I think I'm closer to understanding Delmar's objectives, but, you know, some of these things are just, it's not a, I don't want to say that it's a function of leadership not leading properly, because I don't know the solution. I don't know the answer. These are huge changes just in terms of the society. And those are hard things for a corporate entity to turn around, especially, you know, on a sport like horse racing. So I really can't fault any, and believe me, I would if I could. If I could point the finger at someone and find a solution, I would do those things, but I just don't see it. I don't know what the answer is. You know, I think the industry is trying to educate people into the actual care that the horses are giving, and to negate this foisted public perception that the trainers and the owners are insensitive to the animals, because that's just not the case. But it's just hard to overcome. So I guess education would be an approach, but I'm not very positive or convinced or optimistic that that's going to turn the tide of things. And hopefully I'm wrong.
Darryl, what was, out of curiosity, what was your entree into the sport?
I grew up in Burbank, Glendale area of California, and that was the seat of all of the livestock contractors for the movies. So almost all the horses that you see in the movies in that period of time, I knew those horses. I knew who they were. I worked at the stable and broke some of those horses. So I was just a horse fanatic from the word go.
Wow.
And then I got involved in show horses, hunters and jumpers, through my first wife, who was an extraordinarily good horsewoman. And I learned a lot from her at the higher end of horse. The people that I were around, that I was around early in my, let's say, formative years around horses, were basically people who had migrated to California from the Dust Bowl. And they just knew how to make horses do things. It wasn't sophisticated, but they could. I can remember one time the person I worked for was a livestock contractor, and he got an order for a black horse that could sit in the back of a Cadillac. And he said, "Oh, yeah, I've got one." A Palomino horse that he could do about anything with. He dyed the Palomino black, and within a matter of an hour, he was sitting on the back seat of a Lincoln Continental. Those were the kind of people I was around. But my wife was, my first wife was, let's say, much more sophisticated. And I learned a lot of techniques about horses and understanding horses a little differently. And getting around a different kind of horse, getting around horses that had blood in them, as opposed to, you know, cold-blooded horses, which is what I was around as being young. And so anyway, around show horses, I did some judging of equestrian events. And during the time that we're involved with the hunters and jumpers, I would go to the racetrack to try to buy horses that were either too slow or had some injuries, and, you know, rehabilitate them and use them as show horses. And so I became intrigued by the racetrack by going out there and seeing.
Wow.
So that's kind of the evolution of things.
Who'd you latch on to? Who taught you the racetrack?
No one really taught me at the racetrack.
Wow.
I got a horse racing license, a trainer's license, and I can remember the process. There was a lot of interviews, and it was during the time, I can remember, the stewards, it was during the time of the unrest in the colleges, particularly at UCLA, there was a lot of student activity. And I remember one of the chief stewards, when he was questioning me about getting me a license, he said, "You're not going to come out here and cause any trouble, are you?" Well, it ends up, I think it did cause some trouble eventually.
Well, you're in good company on that front. You know, when you mentioned the horsemanship of the Dust Bowl, you made me think of something. Bruce Headley. I remember having a conversation with Bruce. In fact, it was a Breeders' Cup day, and he talked about learning from literally a cowboy that had come to California in a covered wagon. And he said he learned all kinds of unconventional horsemanship from somebody, you know, that, you know, you wouldn't find this in the book, no matter where you looked. It made me think of that.
Yeah, Bruce was a very good friend of mine, and I miss him a lot. The world's not the same without Bruce in it.
Well, and of course, he's had that prop, right? The essentially a ranch right in the minutes away from Santa Anita. It's the crazy, yeah. Right? And
you could take the boy out of the country, but not the country out of the boy. He had chickens and he was very clever with what he could do with the horses. And I think they had an acre and a half. I'm not sure, but he had everything there. He could break them there. He had a place he could even gallop them. He was an improviser and a very, very an exceptional horse person.
He, you know, one thing, Daryl, that I remember that. And every so often I've brought this up with people in terms of schooling horses. He didn't believe in taking horses to the paddock to school them.
He didn't believe in a lot of the conventional things, and he had a reason for it. If you asked him, he'd tell you why. You know, he was always the first person on the racetrack. He didn't warm his horses up. You know, he'd just break off on a gallop, and he said he learned that from such and such, and I learned this from such and such. You know, he was a great storyteller, so give him a chance, he'd tell you why.
Exactly. He thought that it made them nervous, that bringing them over and for schooling, that it would make them more nervous, not less, when it came time to race.
I think that's probably what he thought, and it's probably true with some horses, but not all horses.
Yeah,
you have to look at each of them as an individual. They're not all the same. Just
no.
Like people.
Exactly. Daryl, it was way too long between visits, and I'm. In fact, I think I've been calling. I've texted a couple of times over the last few months, particularly in regard to, you know, some of the things that, you know, the CTT and TOC issues that, you know, that you've gotten involved in, obviously, as a legal, from a legal standpoint. And so I finally said to Parada, to John, I said, send me Daryl's cell, because I'm not having any success reaching you. So now that I've got the number, I hope, you know, when the occasions arise, I can reach out and have you join us.
Okay, Steve, I really enjoyed the conversation.
Very much. Gilded Time, of course, the subject, but so much more to offer when you talk to Daryl Viena, and you know, just you know, the kind of fascinating individual that's drawn to the game and to the sport, and taking that those interests and creating a horse racing law practice to represent and consult. And if you need that help, thoroughbredlaw.com, right? If you need Daryl's,
Steve, I don't need any more business.
You got enough. You got enough things.
More than enough.
Exactly. So that's so true of any number of. There's a little too much on that front, but I'm glad you're there. Daryl, thanks for this.
Okay, thank you very much.
Daryl Viena and Gilded Time. I was really struck by how many people, you know, the big outpouring of affection for him. So wanted to get a chance, and then I knew I wasn't going to miss a chance to talk on some other topics. It looks like Art Sherman tomorrow. So we're also going to try to get Steve Manley tomorrow. He was dealing with an issue, so we'll reboot for both, for Art and Steve. Also, of course, we'll Wednesday, so we'll check in with Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. I want to mention, we got about 8 minutes. A couple of other notes. A wonderful, amazing, generous response by people to yesterday's visit with Chauncey Morris and the fundraising effort of the KTA and the Kentucky Thoroughbred Breeders, the Overwrap Group, Development Fund, and was it KTBOA? KTOB? Anyway, their fund has, in essentially 36 hours, raised almost $250,000. Instantaneously. And since I've glanced at it this morning, Spendthrift Farm donated $75,000 in the last hour. So many people stepping up. Chauncey just sent me some aerial photography. It looks like he was in a small plane, and it's just unbelievable. Just awful. There was did you see the incredible effort by one individual? I'm going to forget his name, but I saw the video yesterday afternoon. Put a big smoker, on the back of his pickup and just drove and set up in the middle of Mayfield and was cooking and providing food for anybody, everybody, who are obviously they've just lost everything. It's very difficult, and it'll be a very tough. You hope that the weather doesn't make things tougher on people too. They're trying to clean up, and I can't even imagine. But so much generosity involved in that truck that Mattress Mac organized is heading down in just a few minutes, actually, and I'm sure that filled right up. So we'll continue to provide any information that we can on that front. I guess I can go ahead and mention this and get out in front of it, because we'll be able to have Jay visit maybe as soon as tomorrow. Word has come in the last 45 minutes from the Hall of Fame, the National Museum of Racing Hall of Fame, the Joe Hirsch Media Roll of Honor. Congratulations to Jay Privman and also Walter Haight and Jack Mann being recognized as well, and added to the roll of honor. It's a huge, incredible distinction for Jay, and I'm sure he'll be just, I'm sure it's got to be a little overwhelming. And of course, you know, the list that he joins is about as august a group as there is. You know, Walter Haight and Jack Mann, of course, are gone, but certainly nice, very nice and appropriate additions. And of course, Haight's name on a National Turf Writers and Broadcasters, one of the awards for Walter Haight, who spent 50 years as a turf writer for the Washington Post. So we'll get Jay's reaction. And just to give you here, in fact, looking at the notes, Jay joins Steve Crist, Charles Hatton, Bill Knack, Red Smith, Russ Harris, Joe Palmer, Jay Hufty, Whitney Tower, Andy Beyer, Ken Hollingsworth, George Ryle, Jim Murray, and many more. So a wonderful accolade for Jay. Excited to hear his reaction. And of course, you know, you heard him the other day after the little vacation, a little less than a week off, but you know, in the wake of his birthday too, a week ago today, and you know, Jay with about as serious a health crisis as anybody our age is going to deal with. And so I'm sure that this is particularly, you know, meaningful and appreciated. It's certainly nice to gain, and you know, acknowledgments like this while you're on the right side of the loam. But you know, that's what's so interesting when it comes to the naming of stakes, when they named the race for Eddie Delahousse, it seemed like you know, this is kind of cool. Name a race after somebody that can come present the trophy. You know, not some son or daughter, or you know, why not let you know, the person who's being recognized for their, you know, their career and lifelong contributions, let them come and enjoy it while they're still with us. I'm all for that. We don't have to wait until you know, until things are after the fact. That, you know, that's one of the parts of that, you know, with Pat Cummings the other day, where Pat and I were bemoaning the Dick Allen, you know, the Hall of Fame missing a, you know, frankly, even if Dick had, it turns out, obviously, even if Dick had not passed last year, in fact, it was just the anniversary, I think last week was the anniversary, the year of that's been, because the picture jumped up of him on one of, I forget the name of what his pony's name was. I'll put that picture up, actually. It's if you've never seen it. I know I saved it. Yeah, there it is. I want to say the pony has a big Blaze. I think his name, the pony's name, may have been Blaze. That's a great picture, Dick Allen. So yeah. And speaking of Philadelphia, by the way, I've just got a minute, but I'll slip this in. For those that may have seen the story, I guess it was probably maybe in the last 2 years, if it was at ESPN or if it might have been 60 Minutes or CBS Sunday Morning, you know, one of those type of stories about the program in Philadelphia, Work to Ride, which is a horsemanship education program. You know, much like what we talk about with TRF and the prisons. This is an inner city stable, essentially. And they've got, they're building a equestrian arena in Philadelphia. And going to renovate the equestrian center in Fairmont Park. In fact, Tina and I are going to Philadelphia for the weekend. This is a really nice story. $8 million capital campaign. They've raised $6 million. It's a very cool. They, you know, racehorses and that are used for inner city youth, and it's one of the real successes of that kind of a program or inner city. So, I wanted to mention that. I had that on the corner of the desk. Coming up toward noon, so we'll send you out to the race day, and we've obviously got plenty to do going into the middle part of the week. Tomorrow, Dick Powell and Sid, we'll get Jay in here to take a bow for his Hall of Fame inclusion, and Art Sherman, as promised, we'll get to Art. Not going to miss a chance for that. And Steve Manley, hopefully Steve gets freed for tomorrow. Thanks to Alan Foreman, Rich Migliori, Dale Vienna today. Good luck if you're playing Tuesday. Opportunities. We'll talk to you in the morning. Also, get your calendar requests in, by the way. OaklawnCalendar@yahoo.com. Send that picture of the souvenir. Hammer said he's starting to go through them and get organized. All right? OaklawnCalendar@yahoo.com. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 3-8-4-6-4-3.